Please turn with me in your Bibles to the book of Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 14. Wherefore he saith, Awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. This is the word of the Lord. Let's suppose that you're in a dream, and in that dream, people are speaking. They're speaking your language. You recognize the words, but they are giving those words totally different meanings from what you understood those words to mean. Not only that, but people are denouncing you. They are slamming doors in your face. They won't let you be part of them. They say that's because of your race, or your sex, or your religion, or some other reason. And you are dumbfounded by this. And so you ask, well, why are you being racist? And they answer, we're not racist, you are. And that's why we hate you, because you're a racist. And then you wake up, and you think maybe you've spend some time in fantasy land, but then you go turn on the news, and you find that on the news they're using the same meanings to words that you just heard in your dream. A recent mayor of Chicago, in fact, once said that to protest racism, she was going to give interviews only to people of color. And you might think, that's racism. Welcome to the world of woke. Cornell University had a policy that they had established a rock climbing course in their physical education department, but only people of color could enroll in that course. And you think racism? No, it's the opposite of racism, they're saying. They just changed the policy later. So what's going on here? It's what we call woke, or critical race theory, cultural Marxism, social justice. These are terms that we hear a great deal right now, and before the summer of 2020, very few people even knew those terms, other than people in the academic community or the media. Now, people are used to hearing the terms, but probably today, the majority of people don't really understand what the terms mean. And so what my hope is today, as I present this message, is that you will become, using Paul's term here, awakened, but not woke. And there's a difference. The last few weeks, we've been talking about the difference between darkness and light. And we saw that Paul says that we are darkness. Not just that we love darkness, or we walk in darkness, but we are darkness, because we have become so saturated with darkness that it's become part of who we are. Darkness, as we saw, produces ignorance, produces evil, morbidity, and fascination with death, and it produces chaos, whereas light does the opposite. Light produces knowledge, wisdom, to use that term again, enlightenment. It produces righteousness. It produces life. It produces order. And Paul uses those terms here in this verse. Christ shall give thee light. In him was light, and the light was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, John says. But the darkness comprehended or overcame it not. Paul here quotes from Isaiah, or perhaps I should say he paraphrases from Isaiah. In the ancient world, quotes were not expected to be verbatim, but he actually has several passages out of Isaiah that he puts together in this verse. In one point, Isaiah seems to be speaking about an awakening from sleep into consciousness. Isaiah 51:17, awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem. And also he speaks about awakening as being an arousal to action. Isaiah 52:1, awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion. And the most common meaning, and the one that seems to be closest to what Paul is saying here, is an enlightenment to new and higher ideas, the very opposite of darkness. Isaiah 60, verses 1 and 2. Arise and rise. Arise, shine, for thy light has come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But the Lord shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. So the term awakened is a common term in Scripture, and it involves all of these things. Arousing into consciousness, arousing to action, arousing to enlightenment with ideas. And the term woke would almost be used interchangeably with enlightenment. Almost used interchangeably with awakening, but it can involve a physical stirring. It can involve a stirring to action. It can involve spiritual enlightenment and new ideas, but not necessarily the same, and not necessarily of the Lord. Satan uses counterfeits, and rather just telling outright lies, which, of course, he could do, but they're usually less persuasive that way. Satan doesn't come to us like a hideous monster saying, follow me and you can burn in hell for eternity with me. Probably wouldn't get a lot of converts that way. Rather, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11, no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness. To make himself more credible, Satan disguises himself and uses counterfeits. He even disguises himself as God. And his servants disguise themselves as though they are servants of God. And so when we see that word woke, we can see some parallels with the term awaken, as we see it in the Scripture, but I would say with a very opposite meaning. So what is woke ideology? Well, we need to understand it, because it underlies so much of what is going on today. As I say, most of us began hearing that term around 2020, during the riots and so on. Now it just permeates our thoughts, our consciousness, and our media, so much more. And the meaning is becoming more and more blatant. It's not necessarily what motivates the average minority person who sees oppression, or even the person out on the street. But it does motivate key leaders of groups like Black Lives Matter and Antifa. So if you can't understand why saying all lives matter is racist, but saying Black Lives Matter is not racist, you need to understand woke theology. If you can't understand why some are outraged about a white policeman killing a black suspect, but utterly concerned about rioters killing black policemen and looting black businesses, you need to understand wokeness. If you can't understand why some demand that you listen to them, but refuse to listen to you, because they say, you have nothing to say, you have no authority to speak, because you haven't experienced oppression, because you are not part of an oppressed identity group. That may not make sense to you right now. By the end of the message, I hope it will. But if you can't understand those things, then we need to explore what is meant by woke theology. Not agree with it, but understand what woke theology is, and yes, I am calling it theology. So what are its roots? Let me begin with Marxism. Karl Marx was Communism, or as he called it, dialectical materialism, is based in large part upon Darwinian evolution. In fact, Marx even said that Darwin has given me a biological basis for the class to struggle, but the struggle for survival that is going on, the survival of the fittest, Marx said that struggle is between the wealthy classes, and by wealthy he meant anybody that isn't utterly destitute, the bourgeoisie, and the poor classes, that is, the proletariat. By proletariat, he meant the working classes. That gradually changed, and today it means the classes that are not working. But there is a constant struggle, Marx said, between the wealthy and the poor, the oppressive rich and the oppressed poor. And that constant struggle is going to lead to violent revolution, which is going to lead to a classless society. Equality for all. As a matter of fact, wherever communism has been tried, it's done the exact opposite. It has led to totalitarian thought control, as well as mass starvation and genocide. But that was the theory. In the 1900s, a variation of Marxism came. We call it cultural Marxism. And of all these terms we're using here, social justice, wokeism, critical race theory, cultural Marxism probably is the most accurate description. The cultural Marxists, particularly those in the Frankfurt School in Germany, emphasized that, yes, Marx was right when he spoke about a struggle between oppressor and oppressed. But he was way too narrow, because he talked about that oppression, that oppression, in terms of rich versus poor. In fact, the oppression is far broader than that. It is between cultural classes, ideologies, sex, race, religion, etc. There is racial oppression, there is sexual oppression, religious oppression, so many other kinds. In fact, the Frankfurt School, I'd have to say, did an excellent job of managing to create class conflict, managing to put people at odds with one another so they would be in conflict, because that furthered their end of revolution. The Frankfurt School migrated to Geneva in the 1930s, and from there to American universities. Some of us remember the New Left radicals and their riots on campus during the late 1960s. And the difference between that and what was going on in our day was, at that time, local government and local police forces were on the side of law and order. In the more recent things that we've seen, it seems like some of the local governments and the police forces that have to do their bidding were on the side of the lawlessness. But anyway, that was the 1960s, and as the 70s and 80s came, the hippies and yippies became yuppies and decided it wasn't so bad to have some wealth after all, but nevertheless didn't totally lose their ideology. And some of them kept the ideology totally and went to work in universities, the media, in school curricula and things like this, managed to find their way into positions where they could be an influence for a new generation. And what we have seen in the last few years has really been a new generation of that old group that was called the New Left at the time, the radicals of the 1960s. It's different, but has some of the same roots. The goal, they say, is absolute equality, where nobody oppresses anybody else. Because there is one absolute, and usually they'll say there are no absolutes, but they'll call this an absolute, and that's that oppression is always wrong. And so the ultimate sin, they wouldn't use the word sin, but the ultimate sin is being an oppressor. And your salvation from that sin is becoming woke, realizing that you've been an oppressor, and allying yourself with the oppressed and fifth. As we seek to end oppression, the woke principles here, the cultural Marxists, would stress several things, and so I'm just going to give you a few points to understand. And by the way, on the sheet that I've handed out there, one side of that sheet was the Bible study from Woodland, the other side is some definitions that might be helpful for you to follow. But one is that in economics, as well as in culture, we have what we call a zero-sum game, meaning there's only a certain amount of influence, only a certain amount of wealth. And if you gain wealth, you are doing so only at the expense of others. Every dollar you make is one less dollar for everybody else. It's lousy economics. It doesn't work that way. In fact, the whole idea is the exchange of goods and services is that both sides benefit. Years ago, I remember when we had horses where we lived, where we still live today. But anyway, our daughter went off to college and decided to sell her horse. So I put her horse, a large quarter horse, put him up for sale on the bulletin board. And I got a call from a rancher who came over to look and tried him out and liked him. And he said he's about 10 years old, and that's just about the age I need. It takes about 10 years to get the foolishness out of a horse, and then they're ready to do some serious work. And he said, I can make that horse into a good working horse. I might even be able to make this horse into a cutting horse. Anyway, so we differed about the price a little bit, and I was asking $1,000. He was offering $800. We settled at $900. Now, the reason, why was I willing to sell that horse for $900? Because I needed the $900 more than I needed the horse, especially with a daughter in college. Why was he willing to part with $900 for that horse? Because he needed the horse more than he needed the $900. In other words, we each came away from that transaction with something better for us than we had before. We benefited from the transaction. And the same is true, theoretically at least, of every transaction you make. You go into the store and buy a loaf of bread. You're willing to part with a few dollars for that loaf of bread because you need the bread more than you need those dollars. The grocer is willing to part with that loaf of bread because he needs the dollars more than he needs the loaf. Both of us get something more, something better for us out of a transaction. And now that rancher, if he was able to take that horse and make that horse into a cutting horse, that cutting horse could be worth many thousands of dollars. And so he has increased the amount of capital. That's what economics is all about. You profit. You become prosperous by producing something that other people need and selling it to them. In other words, wealth, like influence, is not fixed. It is created anew. But the next principle is cultural relativism. Cultural relativism means that all cultures are equal. Cultures that may not even have learned how to use iron, or haven't even invented the wheel, are equal to cultures with very advanced technology. I'm not sure how well that works. I haven't seen a whole lot of lines of people marching through Texas to get into Mexico. But that's the theory, that all cultures are equal. A third principle is that truth is subjective. We talk about different kinds of truth. There's objective truth. Objective truth that water always freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That's true today. It was true 4,000 years ago. It's true over in Africa, and it's true in the dark side of the moon, just like it's true here. That's a basic principle. This lectern is made out of wood. And if I did a chemical analysis of it, it would show that this is wood. That is objective truth. But there's also subjective truth. Subjective truth is the idea that chocolate ice cream tastes better than vanilla ice cream. That's maybe my opinion. Maybe your opinion is the opposite. Maybe I think that Johann Sebastian Bach is the greatest composer who ever lived. Maybe you say no. I see is the greatest composer who ever lived. Or maybe I say Marlene is the most beautiful woman in the world, and every man should say that about his wife. And Bill might say, well, I agree Marlene is beautiful, but I really think Janice is the most beautiful woman, and he should think that. In other words, some things are objective truth, some things are subjective truth. But in woke mentality, there is no such thing as objective truth. All truth is subjective. All truth is a matter of opinion. And we learn truth by experience, and by experience alone. We don't learn truth by reading about it, studying, taking classes. We learn truth through experience. So when we talk about this central feature of life today, oppression, as they put it, we learn about oppression by experiencing oppression, and that's the only way to learn about it. However, oppression has to be understood in terms of identity groups. The world is divided into identity groups. We have rich and poor. We have black and white. We have men and women. We have citizens and non-citizens. We have all different categories like this. And there is oppression among them. Whites oppress blacks. Men oppress women. Citizens oppress non-citizens. Straights oppress gays. And Christians, well, Christians oppress pretty much everybody in this view. And so, if you're going to talk about oppression, the only way you have any authority to talk about oppression is if you have experienced oppression. And the only way you can have experienced oppression is if you are part of an identity group that has been oppressed. And that's where this term that you see in the back there, intersectionality, comes in. Big word, but that's the term that really puts a lot of this together. Intersectionality. You see, you don't belong to just one identity group. You belong to several. I see some men here, and I see some women. And, sorry to put it this way, men, but the women here, and your wives, they automatically have one level, at least, more authority to speak about oppression than you do, because they belong to at least one oppressed identity group. Maybe you feel picked on at home. Doesn't matter. What matters is that we belong to identity groups. Men oppress women. Now, the more oppressed identity groups you belong to, the more oppression you felt, and so the more oppression you understand, and so the more authority you have to speak about oppression. In other words, if you are poor, if you are disabled, if you are a lesbian, if you are an alien, if you are a pagan, if you're non-white, and if you're female, you belong to all these oppressed groups, and so automatically you have experienced all this oppression. Never mind if you may be a billionaire and in a high position of authority in society, but because you belong to those identity groups, you've experienced oppression. And so you have authority to speak about oppression because you understand it. On the other hand, if you are rich, and again, rich means anybody who isn't destitute, if you are healthy, if you are straight, if you are a Christian, if you are a citizen, if you are white, and if you are male, you belong to all these oppressor groups and no oppressed groups. So you've never experienced oppression, and so you have no authority to speak about oppression. You know nothing about it. And what matters is the identity group or groups you belong to. And all oppression has to be understood in these terms, oppressor versus oppressed groups. If a white person robs a black person, that's a crime. If a black person robs a white person, that's getting even. If a man makes a coarse joke about women, that's sexism, and it probably is. But a woman can make the same joke about men, and that's just humor. And it's open season on Christians. In fact, you can say things about Christians that would be perfectly acceptable in the media today that if you said about any other identity group, it would be considered totally offensive. I recall several years ago, I was a poll watcher in a special election in Montgomery. I was assigned to a precinct that was 90%+ black, and I remember a man walked in, middle of the afternoon, to vote, and he started talking to those around him. He was a pretty good-looking guy. He was probably in his 30s, fairly well-dressed, pretty articulate, black. And he said, "I am not for the Republicans, and I am not for the Democrats. I'm for whatever is good for the black man." Okay. But if I had said the exact same thing, except it said white man, I'd be lynched. But it's perfectly all right for an oppressed group to make such statements. Think about that mentality in the minds of a judge or the minds of jurors. You have a case involving a member of an oppressor group, let's say a white, and a member of an oppressed group, maybe a black. Doesn't matter what the facts are. Doesn't matter what the law is. What matters is that we advance social justice by fighting with the member of the oppressed group, regardless of what the facts or the law of the case might be. And so, understanding what this is, we need to look at a couple of the groups that are involved particularly in this. Black Lives Matter is a group that has had a great deal of publicity. And of course, we would all agree Black Lives Matter. But we'd say all lives matter, and they would say that is racist because we need to emphasize blacks because they're being underemphasized today. And so, if you say all lives matter, you are being racist. In fact, the best way to find out whether somebody's racist is just ask the question, are you a racist? If the person answers yes, that settles it. If the person answers no, that proves it. Because that shows that he is so imbued with white privilege that he doesn't even realize how racist he is. Black Lives Matter has its roots in critical race theory and in Marxism. And in fact, its founders openly said that they were trained Marxists. They took that off the website, but it was there. And they stand for many things that don't seem to identify with the black community, even though they call themselves Black Lives Matter. They reject the idea of a traditional family, even though probably the main problem in black homes today is the lack of a father figure. They have strong support for the LGBTQ movement, even though that's not the view of most blacks today. They strongly support abortion, even though black babies are aborted in far disproportionate terms. They are openly anti-Semitic, and it seems to this movement that some black lives don't matter. Black unborn lives don't matter. Black police lives don't matter. Black business owners don't seem to matter. Black crime victims don't seem to matter. Because those are people whose deaths or losses don't support the woke narrative. Then we have another group called Antifa. It stands for anti-fascist. My guess would be that probably 99% of those at Antifa couldn't even give you a good definition of what fascist is, but they're against fascism, supposedly. I don't know of any group in the country, though, that uses fascist tactics more than Antifa does. The violent intimidation of those who they say are fascists, but actually of anyone who disagrees with them. It's been said that If fascism ever comes to America, it will come disguised as anti-fascism. Reagan made a similar statement to that. George Orwell made a similar statement. I can't find he made this actual statement. Hey, I mean, I'll take credit for it myself. No one else can. If fascism ever comes to America, it will come disguised as anti-fascism, and Antifa is the closest thing to fascism we have today. How then do we respond? How then do we uphold the light? First, we need to stand for what we believe. Often, cultural Marxists get away with what they're saying because no one objects. Maybe because they don't really understand the terminology being used or how it's being used. Or maybe because they're intimidated. And we need to emphasize that objective truth does exist. Matt Carden came to me after Church of Woodland today, and he says, if you don't believe in objective truth, try milking a bull. But some things are just plain facts. For example, if you think that you come to an intersection and it doesn't matter whether what coming the other direction is there or not, because if you didn't see it, it's not part of your scheme of things, see how that works out. See how it works out to go out around collecting mushrooms and having them for dinner without using some objective test as to whether this is a mushroom or a toadstool. Point of the matter is, yes, we live by objective reality. We practice objective reality all the time. We buy cars, hopefully at least, based upon good, solid analysis of what this car can do. Try just imagining that you put money in the bank and writing checks on it and seeing how that works out. Try deciding that the law of gravity doesn't apply and stepping off a ladder and see what happens. We live on the basis of objective truth. I build a worldview based on the idea that no objective truth exists. Also, we emphasize that we are created as individuals, not as identity groups. We have rights that are given to us by a higher power, by God, and those are individual rights that apply to all of us, regardless of what identity group we may belong to. And that's the only true basis for equality. A recognition that we are created in God's image. If we believe we're simply the result of the Darwinian evolutionary process, what's to dispute the possibility that maybe some races have evolved better than others by the laws of natural selection? But you might ask this question. What about slavery? Do you agree that slavery is wrong? And anyway, the cultural Marxists will say, well, of course it's wrong, right? You can ask a stupid question like that. Of course it's wrong. Okay, if slavery is wrong today, does that mean it's wrong here in the United States today, where it is illegal and where it goes against society's norms? Or is it wrong everywhere? What's wrong everywhere? Has it been wrong everywhere at all times? All kinds, everywhere. Of course, there's no exceptions to that. This is silly. Okay, so you're saying that slavery was wrong even in the American South in the early 1800s when it was legal and accepted by society? Yes, of course it was wrong then. And it's wrong when practiced by Muslims today too? Well, yes, I guess so. And it was wrong if it was practiced by the Romans and by the Greeks? Yes. So you're saying that there is a higher law that says slavery is always wrong, regardless of what cultural norms might say otherwise, regardless of what laws or constitutions might say otherwise. Yes, it is always wrong. Get it? Always wrong. Why? Are you saying that there is some higher law that makes slavery always wrong? And if there is a higher law, where did that law come from? God. And if God established an absolute that slavery is always wrong, is it possible then that maybe he's established some other absolutes as well? And maybe we can find out about those absolutes by looking at the scripture. Ultimately, cultural relativism always shoots itself in the foot in the end. Because it has no basis for saying anything is wrong. If you don't believe there are any absolutes at all, then why is oppression wrong? If you believe that all cultures are equal, then what's wrong with my culture if my culture believes in racism, or if my culture believes in oppression? What's wrong with that? Or what are we going to do then as we seek to combat some of this false thinking? Well, as we deal with those involved in the cultural Marxist movement today, first of all, we need to understand where they're coming from. Some of them may have just picked up a few terms here and there and don't really fully understand them. Others might have never heard any other side. Others might be thoroughly indoctrinated into this viewpoint. And normal ways of defending the faith don't necessarily apply there. You can quote statistics about race, about crime, about poverty, but if you're talking to somebody who believes all truth is subjective and thinks only in terms of experience, statistics probably aren't going to mean much. If you give that person the rational arguments for the existence of God, and some of those rational arguments are very good, but somebody who isn't inclined to find truth based on reason isn't going to be impressed by rational arguments. If you give that person the evidence that Christ rose from the dead, and that evidence is overwhelming and impressive, but if the person is not used to thinking in terms of evidence, that probably won't mean much. What do you do with somebody who thinks subjectively in terms of experience? You talk about your experience. You talk about what Christ has done for you. You talk about how Christ has changed your life. And then the person may listen. And you also become part of that person's long-term frame of reference by establishing a long-term relationship with the person. And you do it with humility. Your testimony may be the best way to lead a woke person to Christ, or at least open the door of his thinking. So that he comes to realize that woke doesn't necessarily mean awakened. And so as we look to our text today once again, be awakened without becoming woke. Wherefore he saith, awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light.